anymore, presently.
People ask me always where I'm from, and I've been residing in many different places, and it's hard for me to remember where I'm actually from. I grew up in the West Coast in Tacoma, Washington, and I grew up pretty mainstream, not very practicing Jew. You know, a couple times a year, synagogue, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Bar Mitzvah, bagels and cream cheese. That was about my Judaism for most of my life, until most of my growing up. And it wasn't doing it what I needed. It wasn't giving me everything I felt I needed, and I started looking elsewhere, because that's all as far as Judaism was, that's what I knew. And Judaism wasn't giving, so I looked other places. I looked at other traditions, other philosophies, things like Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, communism, atheism, nihilism, and so on. I really was trying them all out. And it was a little bit of a serendipity that I rediscovered spirituality in Judaism. It was only because I think made an effort to go learn something. It wasn't that I just was dragged into a business lunch where there was a great speaker. I actually thought, you know, I really don't know anything about Judaism. I have a whole talk about that, how I had been in rural Mississippi, surrounded by people who knew my people's book better than I did. And I started feeling really ignorant about my Judaism. And I just made a determination, I got to go learn something. And in learning something, I realized, wow, there's a lot in here that I didn't know. The Judaism that I grew up with was not representative. It was a, you know, imagine a tree, flowering tree, and there's like one branch that is kind of withered, and that's the Judaism I grew up with. It was something, and I am thankful to my parents and community for giving that to me, but it wasn't representative of the whole tree. Now, what I'd like to do today is focus on three ideas that you should walk out of here with, maybe three new ideas. One is maybe a renewed and deeper definition of what spiritual actually means. Because this is a word that's, let's face it, it's become cliche in American English language. And I'd like to get beyond that cliche and really have a rigorous definition of spiritual that works for you, that you can then measure your own growth in life, in your own spirituality, so that that you can actually grow and have an increasing meaningful. I usually ask the question, I probably should ask you to raise your hands, but I'm not going to. I usually ask people, say, okay, raise your hand if you consider yourself spiritual, and about 70% will raise their hands. Then I'll say, well, raise your hand if you'd like to become even more spiritual than you are, and everybody always raises their hands. And I assume that that's true of everybody here, and that's maybe why you chose to come today. So we have to have a definition. And number two, I would like you to walk out of here with some kind of direction in your spirituality, so that it's not just a definition, and I'll, you know, go for it, but you actually feel like, oh, there's a path I can go on that works for me without having to be what we think of as religious. And number three, I would like you to walk out of here today with at least one practical tool, if we can get one, that you'll be able to start putting into practice immediately the second you walk out of this room. How does that sound? Are we on the same page?
Yep.
So I want you to hold me to it. I know we're limited time, and in fact, the original title of this talk, which I created some time ago, is "Does a Spiritual Person Wear a Watch?" And that's the framework I'm going to give you. I'd like to start you off, though, with a story. And the story comes from one of the great masters of spiritual teaching, known as the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov tells the following story about a very, very poor Jew living in Eastern Europe. A lot of these Hasidic stories are poor communities in Eastern Europe. And he and his family are so poor, they don't know what to do. And they heard, they're scraping. They're malnourished. They're not getting enough to live on. And they hear a story, a legend, about an island across the sea, where if you go to this island, the streets are literally paved with precious gems. Sounds like a fantasy, but when you're desperate enough, you're willing to go for a fantasy. There's only one catch. There's a one single boat that goes to the island. It takes a year to get there. And so you have to go there, and then you have to wait for the next boat. So how long do you have to be there? How long do you have to be gone? A year to get there, 2 years for the boat to come back, and then a year to get home. So you're talking about a 4-year venture. That's the catch. So he's going to have to be gone for 4 years. So he and his wife decide they're so desperate they have no other choice. So he goes on this journey. And he gets to this island after a year on the boat. And guess what? The legend was absolutely true. It wasn't a myth. The streets are paved with gems. And he's so excited. He just starts filling his pockets with these diamonds and rubies and so on. And after a while, he gets hungry. So he goes to a local store to get some food. He loads up his shopping cart there. And, okay, it's a little bit anachronistic. The shopping cart was invented in 1953. But he fills up a shopping cart, by a Jewish retailer, by the way. He fills up his shopping cart, and he goes to pay, and he pulls out some diamonds, and they put them on the counter, and they say, "You can't spend those here." "Why not?" "The streets are lined with diamonds. They're not worth anything on this island." He said, "Oh. Well, what can I spend? What's valuable here?" They say, "Well, the thing that everybody spends here for currency is schmaltz." If you don't know what schmaltz is, because you're not that generation, it's rendered chicken fat. Okay, that's what you have to spend here. He says, "Well, I don't have any schmaltz, and I'm hungry." So they give him a little job sweeping the floor, and they let him earn a little bit schmaltz so he can. And you know, he has to be there for a year, and he starts dealing in schmaltz because that's the currency of the island. And after a while, he actually becomes quite successful. He becomes a very successful schmaltz trader. And he's amassing quite a fortune in schmaltz. And when the boat comes back after 2 years, he has this huge fortune of schmaltz. He's loading it into the boat, into the hull of the boat. And the captain calls all aboard, and he goes up the gangplank. And as the boat's pulling away, he's thinking to himself, "Am I forgetting something? I know there's something I'm not remembering. And he just can't remember what it was what he came to the island for. He has this fleeting memory, and it's too late. Because the boat's pulled away. A year later, he pulls up back home. Now, what happens, you think, to a load of schmaltz in the bottom of a boat after a year? It's like this one of those barges, you know, that you see in the news sometimes, full of garbage that no one wants to take in the port. He pulls up to the port, and he is the laughingstock of the town. His wife is humiliated. And he's humiliated. He completely had forgotten his mission, and he goes home that night, and he's just exhausted, and can't bear life anymore. His wife is you know, cleaning his clothes, and she's emptying his pockets. She finds a few diamonds left in the pocket of his jacket that he had forgotten about, and it's enough to feed the family the rest of their lives. And she says, "Honey, you're a genius." He says, "I'm an idiot." Do you hear the analogy? This world that we live in right now is Schmaltz Island. And what we are trading in material goods aren't worth anything in the place we came from and the place we're going back to. Worth nothing. Zero. They have no value. The things that are valuable over there aren't worth anything here. And that's our challenge. We got to live here. We have to live here. We're not supposed to be poor. We're not supposed to be feeling, you know, sick, and we're not supposed to be unhealthy. So how do you live in this world and have a healthy life while amassing the currency that really is valuable? How do you do the two things at the same time and not get too caught up in the schmaltz race? Because you need schmaltz to live on here, but you don't want to lose sight of the perspective. And technology is one of these things that is neutral, right? Technology has the potential to help us and has the potential to get us lost, totally lost. How do we maintain our perspective? And I'm going to offer this to you as perhaps a definition. I promised you a definition of this word, spiritual. I would like to propose to you a definition of spiritual is the degree to which you or I, a person, the degree to which a person is aware of the real value of the material possessions and pursuits that we have. The degree to which I'm aware of that every day and I have the right perspective on that would be a measure of how spiritual I am. So, for example, a person who is totally caught up in material things and has no sense of perspective of higher values, that person I would say is not a very spiritual person. But a person who has a very healthy perspective and realizes all these material things that we're pursuing are for a higher purpose, that person is a more spiritual person. And that's maybe a definition you can work with, and you can actually measure your own self and ask yourself, well, how spiritual am I today? And am I more spiritual today than I was a year ago? And if not, what do I need to do about it in order to go on a more spiritual path? It's interesting because in English, the whole language we have that we use every day is not a spiritually friendly language. I'll give you an example to contrast English with Hebrew, which is a spiritually friendly language. In English, everything is about possession. For example, anyone here have a doctor? No, you don't. It's not your doctor. You don't own your doctor. But we talk that way. We talk, everything we say, many things we say, it's about possession, even though it's not really about possession. How do you say, my doctor, or I have a doctor in Hebrew? Does anybody know? Yesh li. There is towards me. Or for, right? It's about a relationship. It's not about possession. There's no word in Hebrew to say, I have, in the same way we say in English. It's about, the word is yesh le, which indicates a relationship. It's a very different way of relating to things when you express it differently. And we don't appreciate that because we're thinking in English. So this is something to be aware of and something to start thinking about how you relate to things. Now, what's confusing us, and really the heart of it, and the reason that English is doing this and it's reinforcing itself as a loop is because nobody knows the answer to the following question. I shouldn't have said that because now you're going to be thinking I'm asking you a trick question. Raise your hand, please, ladies and gentlemen, if you believe, just a belief, not a question of knowledge, what's your honest belief? Do you believe that you have a soul? Almost everybody. Even people who were with me last year who maybe forgot that the answer, correct answer is, regardless of what you believe, that you're wrong. Let me be the first card-carrying rabbi to tell you you're wrong. You don't have a soul. You never expected a rabbi to tell you that, I'm sure. But this is why you come to Jet and Rabbi Kahn, because he brings you people who are going to tell you the truth. You don't want somebody to make you comfortable. You want somebody to tell you the truth. I'm telling you like it is. You don't have a soul. What's the correct understanding of the word soul? You are a soul. You have a body. And that shows you, the fact that most of you raised your hands to ask the question, even if you knew this already but you were kind of forgetting, it shows you how much you've been brainwashed by the messages of our society, the media and so on, that is telling you day in, day out, you are a body, you are a body, you are a body. So much so that you raise your hand. You should react to that as if I said to you, raise your hand if you believe that you have a self or you have a person. You would say, what are you talking about? I am a person. That should be your reaction if I say you have a soul. But it's because of the brainwashing of the language and the media that we're very confused. And that is another way of expressing this definition of this word spiritual. A spiritual person is one, or the degree to which you're spiritual, the degree to which you are aware that your true essence is soul, and your temporary essence is soul fused to body. The body is very important, and we don't deny the body. We're not a religion where we say, let's go on a mountaintop and starve ourselves, and that's how we become spiritual. That's not Judaism. Judaism is not about denying the body, but it's about using the body correctly as a vehicle to elevate the soul, as opposed to as something just to feed and fatten up and make comfortable. You hear that? So that's step number one, is really understanding this. And you can measure yourself again on a daily basis. How are you today? How were you last week? How were you last year in the terms of this awareness? How much are you living like a soul and not living like a body? It's a little meditation you can do in the morning. When you go to the bathroom in the morning and brushing your teeth, just look in the mirror. And before you go to bed, look in the mirror and say to yourself, I'm a soul. I'm a soul. Get the idea into your head. And you find, just getting that idea into your head and not getting trapped by the media, you will find yourself more elevated, just being that aware. I once heard a colleague of mine in Los Angeles tell that, you know, anyone here been to Los Angeles? Okay, you know what Los Angeles is like, right? So he said that his daughter they're driving down the streets of Los Angeles, and his daughter says, this is a religious family, and his daughter, who's like 5 years old, says, Abba, she's pointing to a billboard, why is that woman in her underwear? Now, based on what I've just said just till now, what do you think his answer might be? What would be a good answer for a five-year-old girl based on this wisdom of what spiritual means? Why is the woman in her underwear? I'll tell you what he told her. Because she's confused. She thinks that she's a body. And she doesn't realize that she's really a soul. And that's where the tradition comes from of being so modest with our bodies. Because if I show you my body, see, I want to connect to you. So if I think that I'm a body and you're a body, so we should connect as bodies. But if I realize that, no, our essence is souls, I should kind of cover up the body a little bit so you don't get distracted by my body, and that we can connect as souls. That's where that comes from. I was looking at a book last night on the Holocaust, and I saw a picture that made me so shaken and sad. I wish it wasn't in the book. It was a picture of Jewish women in the Holocaust who were made to strip down to take their clothes off. And it, I mean, you don't need to print that stuff. Okay, I know it happened. They can tell me about it. But it's so against this core Jewish value of living, of spiritual living. It really hurt me to see that they put that in the book. This is the illusion that our society gives us about material. The material world is all there is, and you can't see anything spiritual, you can't measure anything spiritual, you can't study it scientifically, and therefore it doesn't exist. And that's an illusion that 3,000 years of Jewish history is trying to correct. It's not just a new thing in American society. The Egyptian society of old had that illusion. Babylonian society, Greek, Hellenistic society for sure had it. Roman society, all these societies had this illusion. And this is why they hated the Jews so much, because we were saying constantly throughout our history, there's more to life than just this material world. And that's essentially what it means to be a connected Jew, is to have that awareness. It doesn't have to be just a Jewish thing. Obviously, a non-Jew also can have such an awareness. But that's the mission. That's the mission statement of the Jewish people, is there's more to life than the material world, and don't get trapped by it. Okay, so I'm not trapped by it. So I assume you all agree with that point. But the fact is, my body needs things, right? I've got to eat. I have got to do a lot of things. Material things are necessary to live. So what do we do about this? This two... I don't want to have a dichotomy, but I have a dichotomy. Has anybody here found a solution in your own life that to this problem of this? I know that I should be more spiritual, but I got these needs. I've got physical needs, material needs. And don't talk about religion, okay? I don't hear anything religious. Right? No one's found any solutions. Okay, that's why you came today, because you want to hear my solutions. Fine. So... you know, I just want to focus the problem a little bit. It's not just that our bodies have needs, but our bodies' needs are by and large automatic. Like, I can't really control my body's needs. There are certain laws of nature. A person doesn't eat or drink, their soul will eventually become separated from the body, right? Isn't that what happens when a person stops eating and drinking for long enough? Their soul, if for my soul to stay clinging to my body, I have to do things like eating and drinking. I have to get proper rest and many, many other things. And there's laws of nature that I'm stuck in, so I can't fight that. You know, I have to work with, I have to groove with that. At the same time, I don't want to get caught by it. So somehow I got to do that, and I've got to maintain this awareness. Look at this word on the board. Soul and body. Now they're connected together, but I want to maintain this awareness of who my real essence is. What is the soul? The more I analyze it, the more I can be aware of it and stay in tune with it. So I use the word soul, and we've talked about it. I asked you if you have a soul, but what is it? Where does it come from? What do you think? Any theories? Yeah?
Piece of God.
Piece of God. Well, that's a good start, and I like that you mentioned that, but I wish you could leave God out of it. I say
that... can I rephrase?
I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but you know, whenever I encounter a new group of people, I don't know what page you're on, and if you're on the same page as me. When I first came back to America from Israel, from studying in yeshivas in Israel for 7 years, I was sitting in Silicon Valley with one of the top 10 venture capitalists according to Fortune magazine, and he was a Jewish guy who had been through Jewish schools, and he looked me in the eye and he said, "Rabbi, I don't know what we have to talk about. You see, I don't believe in God." I looked him back in the eye and I said, "That's okay, I don't either." He thought I was crazy. And then I explained to him, "I'm sure whatever you mean when you say God, I don't believe in that either." You know why? Because, and I think I said this last year, if you were with me a year ago, I'm of the opinion that the greatest stumbling block to Jewish spirituality, perhaps even non-Jewish spirituality, in all of human history, was a guy named Michelangelo. You know what I'm talking about? What did Michelangelo do to our spirituality? He gave us a cartoon, literally a cartoon image of God. Do you know what I'm talking about? The old man with the white beard? Do you agree with me that he gave us this that's a cartoon image? Think about it. Whenever someone wants to depict God, how do they draw God? I carry this around to illustrate. This is in the news for the newspaper. Right? This says, "I'm sorry, God, I'm afraid it has so many problems it's beyond repair. I suggest you toss it and create a new one." Whenever God's depicted, it's the Michelangelo image. By the way, after thinking about this and teaching this for a few years, I finally figured out why Michelangelo did it. You want to know why? You want my theory of why he chose this image for God? See, they believe that Jesus is the Son. So how are you going to make God look? Like an older version. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, there's nothing... I'm not really picking on him for that. That's fine. But you see what it did to us by giving us this cartoon image is it totally gave us it's really a childish image. God is a man. God is an old man. Yes, the Torah uses the word he for God a lot, which is a Kabbalistic idea we have to explain another time. But that's not God. If that's what you think of God, then I'm not on the same page as you. I don't necessarily think you think that. I was just that's why I said a little tongue-in-cheek. But you're absolutely right to raise the topic. The definition of soul has to do something with something higher than us. Okay? I prefer, because of this baggage we have culturally, to use some other terms. For instance, the number one term I use in my book is this. The infinite. I put a "the" in front of it. The infinite. What does that mean, the infinite? Well, if you mean, you know, let's just leave the word God out for a second. What does infinite mean? Goes on forever and ever and ever.
And there's no start or beginning.
What does that have to do with you and me?
Our soul goes on forever and ever and ever.
Maybe.
Maybe. We don't. Our body doesn't. But maybe there's a part of us that does.
Let's make it a little bit more scientific, okay? Anyone here study physics ever? One person? Okay, physics says that starts with Einstein over 100 years ago. About 100 years ago, Einstein started developing the theory of general relativity and realized that the universe is expanding. And based on the idea that the universe is expanding, we have a little bit of a problem. Even if you're not a physicist, you should be really bothered by the idea of an expanding universe. Because if you're a thinking person, you realize a universe that had a beginning means you have to ask the following question. If the universe had a beginning, what came before that? You don't have to be a scientist to ask the question. You have to be a thinking person. It's an obvious question you have to ask. If the universe had a beginning, what came before that? Science has no real good answer. There's some speculation now. They call it string theory and so on. It's all speculation. There's no way they can measure it or observe it, so it's really outside the realm of science. What does Judaism say? The Judaism says, before there was the finite world, the finite universe, there was something. It was not finite. What do we call something not finite? Infinite. I mean, that's just the word we have. But understand this. Infinite is the source of everything. Now, if you want to label that God and you're on the same page, we're talking about something infinite beyond all comprehension, then we're probably on the same page. But we have to be very careful of the terms. Judaism says this is number one thing to understand. That's the source of everything. Now, let's put our thinking caps back on a second. Put yourself in God's shoes for a second. You're the infinite, okay? You can do anything. You all right? You're infinitely big, infinitely powerful, infinitely intelligent. What would you create a world for? What would be the motivation for making a big bang in the whole universe? Any suggestions? Any theories? Is there anything that an infinite being can get out of creating a world? By definition, no. Because getting something implies lacking something, and infinite means not lacking. Therefore, by definition, there's nothing God can get out of creating this world. And this is what made Abraham who Abraham was. Right? Abraham was... What was Abraham? The first what? The first Jew, you said? Oh, I heard from someone he's the first Muslim. What made him the first... Whatever he was, what was his great insight that made him unique?
Monotheism.
That's what you heard, right? It's another lie I have to dispel. Just look in the Torah. There were monotheists before Abraham. There was Adam, there was Noah, and there were others. But Abraham's monotheism was sophisticated. He said, wait a second. If what created all this beautiful world was something infinite, it couldn't have done it for itself. Because an infinite being doesn't need anything. Therefore, why must it have created the universe?
Pure love.
For us. Do you hear this? For giving to us. Because there's nothing it could get. Because it's infinite. That was his logic. So we were therefore created, said Abraham, in order for this infinite being to be able to give. Because without a recipient, how can you give? Do you hear this? What I'm teaching you is the most important secret you'll ever hear your entire life. I've just told you the purpose of every one of our lives, and of every molecule in this universe, including ourselves, which is what? To enable this infinite giver to give. And therefore, what is our job to do? To receive. And this was Abraham's insight, and he said, I want to learn how to do that. I want to learn how to be a great receiver of this. And he figured out how to do it. He taught it to his children and his grandchildren. That wisdom comes down to us in a system known as Judaism. That is Judaism properly framed. Is a system to teach us how to maximize our ability to be recipients of all the goodness that is being offered to us. It's a tremendous idea. And that therefore, let's go back to this question, what is soul? What means soul? Soul is that aspect of self that is I use the word piece of the infinite. The only problem I have with that word, piece, is it implies you could divide up an infinite into pieces. But the problem is our brains can't really conceive of something infinite anyway, so we're dealing with things outside of our intelligence. But I would like to say maybe a spark or a wavelength of. Okay, do you hear what I'm saying? I'll give you an example, the counterexample. Everybody touch the table, please. Okay, is this table you're touching finite or infinite?
Finite.
You all agree this is a piece of bona fide 100% finiteness, right? So you therefore agree here's a place where there's no God. You said it's finite and we're defining God as infinite. So you agree there's no infinite here, right? But you agree that it's finite. And infinite means not finite. It's a paradox. How is it possible for infinite and finite to coexist? It is a paradox. Do you guys know the answer? Or is that too weird for you? Should I tell the answer? I'll give you a hint to the answer. You ever been to a costume party? Remember the last time you were at a costume party? Just think about it. You know, there's the George Bush, and there's the Hillary Clinton, and there's the gorilla. Since I don't know your politics, I don't know which is scarier for you, so we'll just leave it at that. Okay, the gorilla comes up to you and says, "Guess who?" And you're listening to the voice, you think, "Dave." No. You look how high, tall the person is. "Joe." No. You listen one more time. "Mike." Yeah, you got it right. What's Mike going to do once you guess right? Typically,
take off
the mask, right? The mystics say that this finite world we live in is actually a mask for the infinite. It's actually a mask. And those people who work on their spirituality enough and integrate spiritual wisdom into their self, in their perspective enough over a lifetime, where they can recognize who is behind the mask, for them the mask is removed. And they no longer perceive this paradox that we are dealing with. We're trapped in it because we don't see who's behind the mask. And for us it seems like it's finite. In a sense, what I'm telling you is not really, so to speak. And you know what? Science has kind of hinted at this as well. Because we all know from our high school science days, right? This table's moving right now, right? It's all vibrating. We just can't perceive it because the vibration's so tiny, right? So we know intellectually that that idea is not so strange to us. And I'm not telling you that that's what Judaism is saying about God, that God is vibrating in the molecule. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the idea that the table is not what it appears to be is not a new idea to us. So that's helpful. In fact, there's statements in the Zohar, the great book of Kabbalah, that the revelation of spiritual wisdom will parallel a scientific revolution in the future. The Zohar is written in the 13th century, so this it was predicted this would start happening around the 18th century. It's exactly when it started happening, the scientific revolution. So how do we do it? How do we then integrate this wisdom into our lives and become more spiritual? And I've given you some wisdom about what spiritual means and what a soul means. So how do we do this? So there's a neat thing in Hebrew. Anyone know the word for... I know some Hebrew speakers. How do you say I? Like, I speak Hebrew. How do you say it in Hebrew? You know the word ani? You've heard this word before? Ani? The Hebrew word for I is ani. Anybody know this word? Anyone know what this means? It's actually the feminization of ani. In Hebrew, you know, there's masculine and feminine, like in Spanish and French. The feminine version of ani is aniya. It's interesting what it means. It means boat. And aniya is a boat. Now, there's no accidents in Hebrew. This is a very spiritual language. In Hebrew, the language is teaching us that living, the I, that's the, by the way, if you study psychology or psychiatry in Hebrew, the word for ego, what the Freud took the word from Latin, ego, the Hebrew word for ego is ani. It's the same word. They call it ha-ani, the ego. The idea of the I, it being a boat, is the metaphor is just like a boat is sailing through the water, I am sailing through this world. And just like a boat can rock and be in danger or it can be steady, so can I. And I need to be able to learn how to be steady in this material world, which is the ocean, which is the sea, and learn how to do it. And sometimes there's big waves. Sometimes there's big temptations. Sometimes there's big challenges. And I have to be able to learn wisdom to keep me steady. And I'd like to give you three. I told you I'd give you a couple examples of how you can do this. I'm going to give you three examples of Jewish wisdom and how to maintain your steadiness as a boat, no matter what kind of storm hits you from the material side, whether it's a financial crisis or some great temptation or whatever, or a ethical crisis in your life or your business or your family. Whatever it is, how do you maintain your spiritual steadiness through all those things that happen? So there's three things I'll share. One of them you've heard about before, and so I'm starting with what's familiar to you, and there are these basic things like Jewish meditations. Now, you all heard about Jewish meditations, and you maybe didn't think about them meditations. You might have thought they were prayers, but they're not prayers. What is a prayer? What does the word pray mean? If you read Shakespeare, what does pray mean? I pray, tell me. What does that mean? Asking, right? Prayer is a request. What I'm talking about is not prayers. I'm talking about meditations. What's the greatest Jewish meditation ever written? It's called the Shema. The Shema Yisrael is not a prayer at all. It's a meditation. It's a tremendous meditation. You know what it's about? It's about the infinite creator of everything is really infinite. That's what it's about. It's about closing your eyes and getting in touch with this wisdom about an infinite creator. It's tremendously powerful. I have a whole chapter in the book on it. It's very hard to do. But once you get it and understand what it means, you can do it in about 30 seconds, twice a day. The custom is to do it in the morning when you first get up and evening before you go to bed. And there's a whole way of doing it to maximize its work on your mind and on your heart so that it really sinks in that wisdom. If you frame your day with the Shema, it becomes a powerful tool to maintain that steadiness throughout the rest of the day. Similarly with other meditations we have. That's what they're for, folks. Everything in Judaism that we have into our liturgy, all the prayers and blessings and so on, are really only to help us be centered the rest of the time. I'm not even advocating right now that you go to shul. I'm not sure that going to shul is the best thing for you. I wouldn't say to do it. Not necessarily. It depends on the shul. Some shuls are really not great places to go. It's not about going to temple. It's about developing the spiritual awareness. And if you have a synagogue that helps you do that, fantastic. If you don't go. But do learn about how the liturgy, through this book or other books that can help you, learn how that can actually transform your life personally. It's really between you and yourself and the transcendent creator. That's number one. Number two is kind of like a prayer, but it's not one like you've ever heard before. And this wisdom comes from Rabbi Nachman. He's a famous Hasidic teacher from the from 150 years ago. And the truth is, he didn't invent this. Every great Jewish mystic for the last 3,000, I dare say 4,000 years, has practiced what I'm about to tell you, and this is what made them great. It's not in my book, by the way. You won't find this in the book. I thought it was too advanced for the book. And then after I finished publishing the book, started teaching, I realized that maybe I should have put it in, but I didn't put it in. This practice is like this. We talked about this paradox, infinite, finite. If you're real, if you try, even pretend to be real, with the idea that there's an infinite reality that you could tap into, then you should be able to understand that theoretically, it should be possible to have a relationship with that infinite. I'll say that again because it's so important. If you consider the possibility that there's an infinite creator of the universe, even as a possibility, even if you're not sure about it, even if you're saying, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but if it's possibly true, it should be possible to have a relationship, because if it's truly infinite, if this is an infinite being, I should be able to have a relationship with this being. I'll put it in really colloquial terms for you. Is there anything stopping God from making you a millionaire tomorrow? If you're not already a millionaire. A billionaire tomorrow. Is there anything stopping God from making you a billionaire tomorrow? Yes or no? Is there anything that... Is it hard for God to do that?
No.
It should not be, right? Does God care more about saving people's lives than finding you a parking space? Yes or no? What does he care more about? Saving a person's life or finding you a parking space? What do you think?
Yes, I would say he probably cares equally about both. I don't know, Rabbi, is it a trick question?
It's not a trick question. What's our definition?
You your parking space, you get out of the car in time and save somebody's life, so God knows about
that. Oh, that's saving the life. I'm not talking about saving a life. Does God care more about your hangnail or saving a life? If God is defined as an infinite being, by definition, there's nothing greater or smaller from God's perspective.
Right.
By definition. I often get this objection, I don't want to ask God for help finding a parking. That's too small for God. I'll ask him for the big things. Big to who?
Right.
If you say that God is not involved with my hangnail, then you're saying that your God is not infinite. If you're saying God is not an Auschwitz, you're saying your God is not infinite. If God is infinite, God is by definition involved in everything. Your job is to be aware of that. And the way you become aware of that is by speaking in English. Forget Hebrew. Forget prayers and blessing, all that. Just in English. Hey, help me find a parking space. When you find the parking space, by the way, what should you do? Thank you. Right? There's a joke told about the guy who's davening, he's praying, God, please, please, help me find a parking space. Help me find a parking space. Right? He finally finds the parking space. Says, "Oh, never mind, God, I found one. Thanks, though."
What if you don't find one?
Good question. What's the answer to this gentleman's question? What's your name?
Howard.
What's the answer to Howard's question? If you don't find, that's got to be the next question, because half the time, or even more than half the time, I ask for help and I don't feel like I get the help. So I can't say thank you. What do you say?
There's always a parking space. It may not be where you want it to be. It may be further, but there is always one.
Well, he's using that. Howard's using that as an example, but we can take a situation where it does not happen. I'll give you an example. Someone prays to win the lottery tomorrow, and they don't win tomorrow. You could say he could play another day, but he didn't win it the day he asked for it. Or he prays for a healing, and the person doesn't get better. There's lots of times when people ask for things, they don't get what they ask for. Whether the parking space is just an example. So how do we deal with that? How do we deal with a quote-unquote unanswered, so-called unanswered prayer?
God is sovereign.
So God is what?
Sovereign.
What does that mean?
He knows what's best.
Uh-huh. There's an element of faith there. You know, there's the story told, it's probably not a true story, it's just an anecdote. You see how old it is, because it's about a Jewish boy living in Soviet Russia, and they're a very anti-religious, atheistic society. And he is every morning mumbling something, whispering something. The teacher says, "You know, Yitzchak, what you doing?" He says, "I'm praying for what are you praying? She starts making fun of him in front of the class. Our Jewish boy's praying. How isn't that nice, class? What are you praying for? A bicycle? Oh, so he's praying to this. God will give him a bicycle, and then we'll see if that your God ever gives you a bicycle, right? So after like 6 months, she notices he's not doing this anymore. The thing gets old. She stops making fun of him. After 6 months, he stops, and now it's a new chance to mock him again. So, Yitzchak, I see you're not praying. Did you get your bicycle? No. You see, class, there is no God. Because Yitzchak prayed for 6 months to get his bicycle. Yitzchak, do you see that? He says, no, I still think there's a God. Well, how could you believe that if he didn't answer your prayer? He said, he answered my prayer. He said, no. That's the only way you can answer your question. Now, you might be bothered by that. Why no? That's his answer. Well, sometimes you have to. I'm not saying you should just accept it without asking why. Generally speaking, when a person asks why sincerely, they'll get an answer. If they sincerely ask, it might take a few years. But I've heard people tell me years later, 10, 20 years later, now I understand why X was good for me. Back then, I didn't understand it. It hurt. But now I understand. Do you have anyone here ever had to give a child a punishment and the child thought it was unfair? And you told the child, you know, if you'll know one day, you'll thank me for this, right? Spiritually speaking, we're all children. We're all children.
Why not just say, God knows what's best for me. I'm not going to ask for anything. God will give me what I need.
That's another two in a row. Another great question. Very, very important question. Why not just say, well, God knows what's best for me. Why should I ask for anything? Do you hear the question? Anyone have an answer? Well, this is at the risk of going a little bit over time. And I'll try to wrap up now because I know people have to go, but I'll just try to answer this in a nutshell answer. And it's worth, that question is so good, it's worth sitting down with a local rabbi and like really studying it because it's a very, very deep question. But I'll just give you a nutshell taste of an answer. If Abraham's model is correct, and I would like to end with a story. So, am I going way over time now? Because there's one little story I want to tell you. Okay, if you have to leave early, I won't be offended. But if Abraham's model is correct, that we are here in order for this infinite being to be able to give, and we're enabling that, what's the greatest amount of good, theoretically, that an infinite being can give to us? What's the greatest amount? Infinite, right? Would you agree? The greatest amount is infinite. In other words, the greatest thing that God can give us is God, so to speak. The greatest thing that God can give us is a connection to God. Did you know that down the hall from here, there's a door that if you pay the right price and push the right buttons, you can actually go and have a conversation with God? 2 minutes max. Anyone interested? One-on-one. Everyone would like that. Well, there's all kinds of questions you'd like to ask. You'd like to connect, have that connection, right? The greatest thing we can get in life is that connection, okay? But that connection requires me to make an effort. In other words, if you woke up tomorrow morning and found $1 million on your doorstep, a little note from a secret admirer, enjoy, right? Now, you could go spend that and have a great time, right? Let's say you also had another choice. You could go spend this same amount of money, $1 million that you earned with your own effort. Which is going to give you more pleasure spending? The million that you were just given without any effort, or the million that you earned? Isn't earning it give you more pleasure? Do you hear what I'm saying? The effort is part of the reward. The idea of the no pain, no gain is true physically. You cannot build a muscle without resistance, and spiritually too. You need to go through that effort in order to grow. The greatest gift that God can give you is a relationship to the God that you choose, that you make an effort to have. He didn't create you as a robot to automatically be all doing everything good and being a goody two-shoes. You were created with all kinds of temptations and problems and baggage from your parents, etc., so that you could make choices, and that connection you'll end up with will be so much more pleasurable than if you were just programmed that way. So you were given these challenges on purpose to help you become a better person. That's a nutshell answer. I told you it's a really big question. Yeah, it takes a lot more to study. I want to finish with this little story, which I think will frame everything for us. Oh, there's one last thing I didn't say, and I'll just mention it so I can check it off my list. Besides having this Jewish liturgy like a Shema or things like that that help frame your day, and also having this Rabbi Nachman idea of constantly speaking to God, thank you, help me, whatever, that which helps you develop that awareness throughout the day, It's also really crucial, I can't overemphasize how important it is, to have a slice of time on a weekly basis known as the weekend, one day weekend, where you stop all materialistic pursuits and let your soul slumber, just like your body has to slumber every night, your soul has to rest as well. That's the true idea. I ask people, maybe you have a definition for me, what does Shabbat mean? If I ask you, if a child says to you, what's Shabbat mean, what would you say? It is the day of
rest.
So that's number three. Third word you have to erase from your mind, that's not correct. Shabbat is not a day of rest. And I'll tell you the definition, but it requires you to learn from Rabbi Kahn more about it. Shabbat means a day of stopping. The literal definition of Shabbat is stopping. Stopping your everyday pursuits and switching gears completely. That's what Shabbat is, and I don't have to tell you, just like you all know you need a weekend, that's what it's all about. And so that's something to think about. So finally, the last story. The last story is from one of the great sages, Jewish sages of the 20th century. He's known by his nickname, the Chafetz Chaim, and you may have heard of him. He lived in Eastern Europe in Radin, Poland. Lithuania, Poland, that area. Borders changed a little bit. And he was truly a sage. I mean, one of these people that everyone respected, universally respected Jewish sage. He was like a wise man. He died in around 1930. Well, he ran a little store to support himself. He didn't earn money as a rabbi, but he was the great rabbi. And he was not wealthy. And he lived very simply. And then wood benches at home. That's what they sat on, not even chairs. And they had a little extra money one month, and his wife went out and bought some chairs. And the rabbi, the Chafetz Chaim, was unhappy with what his wife did. You know, whatever it means that he got upset, I doubt he raised his voice, because he was such a elevated person. You know, I don't think he got angry, but the story is that he was upset with her. And he said, I don't understand this. Chairs? Today it's chairs, and tomorrow it's going to be paintings? And the next thing you know, it's going to be a clock. That's the ultimate in opulence? Is a clock? I was thinking like goldware or something like silverware. What's a clock? What is it about? A clock for a Jew who's trying to be plugged into Judaism, isn't a clock a very useful thing? You want to say the Shema at the right time. You want to make Shabbat at the right time. You want to make your synagogue. There's all kinds of things that clocks help in Judaism, right? Why would he have objected to a clock? Why would that be like the ultimate in materialism? Any suggestions?
You can make the connection to God whenever you want.
Okay.
Well, then why would you need a clock if you're a Jew?
Well, let's say you know there's going to be a service that we want everyone to get together for a prayer service.
We talked about earlier about how maybe that's not what you mean.
Well, that's a nice idea you're saying, and I agree with you, except that the Chafetz Chaim was a person who went to synagogue three times a day. I'm saying within his own cultural world, how do we understand his objection to the clock? Yeah.
The clock makes the infinite finite.
The clock makes
the
infinite
finite.
What do you mean?
The time is infinite, and we're trying to break it down into pieces, and we can't. So therefore, maybe we're going to start to try to break God down into pieces, and we can't.
You know, I think there's something deep and real about what you're saying. I'm going to try to maybe we'll rephrase a little bit. I think maybe she can add to that. Interesting theory. It's because of Shabbat. Once a week, they should cover the clock up, maybe. That would be that's a nice theory, and I don't mind it. But I think there's even a reason why he might have objected to it on a Tuesday. You see, and I think it's related to what you said about, and what I think everyone's saying is probably true, and let me just bring them all together. You know what happens when you are you notice I'm not wearing a clock, but I have one here. What happens when you have a clock all the time? You're watching it, and it's time to be spiritual now. oh, it's time to go be spiritual now, right? It can compartmentalize your spirituality. It doesn't compartmentalize God so much as your relationship to God becomes compartmentalized. Instead of being all the time, it's like, oh, okay, it's time to go be spiritual. And that makes me less connected. I want to be connected all the time, even when I'm dealing in business, and even when I'm driving down the road, and even when I'm, you know, filling up my gas tank. At every moment, I should try to strive for that connection, not just when the clock says I should. That's my theory, and I think it's related to what all three of you are saying. We need to wrap up. I promised you three things. I want to know if we achieved those three things. I promised you a definition of spiritual. We get that? You happy with the definition? I promised you that you'd have a definition for the purpose of life. How would we do that? Okay with that? Okay, in a nutshell? And I promised you at least one practical tool. Did we get at least one that you can work with, that you can take out of this room? Okay, we've accomplished our purpose. I want to say that I'm going to say thank you and then give you an afterword. I want to thank you again to Jason Apple and Jet for inviting me back to Chicago and hosting us in this room. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Jason. And if there's if you would do anything else Jewishly, if you're really interested in pursuing these, you know, I don't know if Rabbi Kahn has an opportunity. He and I were chatting about the possibility of my coming back and doing a series, maybe 3 months in a row. It's such an easy flight from Baltimore to Midway Airport. Southwest flies. I found it very easy. It's not expensive. So I enjoy this kind of group for me. To be able to speak to intelligent people about things that I think are really interesting, I find very uplifting. So if there's an interest, please either let him know or take my card and send me an email. We can see if we can work it out. And I have a list. I just want to ask everybody who has the time, if you're not rushing out, do me a favor. These are anonymous evaluation forms. They really help me personally and Rabbi Kahn. We want to offer the best of the best. So just fill it out for us. It shouldn't take more. There's 9 multiple choice questions. Take about 9 seconds or 1 minute. I really appreciate it. And if you'd like to be in touch with me, send me an email. I'll write you back and we'll be in touch. Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you.